When Henrietta Lacks died in 1951, little did her family know that her cells would live on indefinitely, being reproduced and used in research all around the world. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'll talk with Lack's grandson about her medical legacy and how his family discovered the use of his grandmother's cells in worldwide research 20 years after her death. We'll also talk with researchers here in Iowa who have worked with the so-called HeLa cells, cells that have led to huge medical breakthroughs, cancer cures, treatments for HIV and Parkinson's, in vitro fertilization, and polio vaccine. The immortal life of Henrietta Lacks after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Her name was Henrietta Lacks, but scientists know her as HeLa. Lacks was a poor black tobacco farmer whose cells, taken without her knowledge in 1951, have become one of the most important tools in medicine. HeLa cells have been vital for many important strides, including developing the polio vaccine, cloning, gene mapping, and in vitro fertilization. Lacks cells have been bought and sold by the billions, and yet she remains virtually unknown, and her family can't even afford health insurance. The 2013 Iowa Book Festival begins tonight with a free community event built around The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. That's the title of a popular science book detailing this incredible story. Victoria Baptiste, Henrietta Lacks' great-granddaughter, and David Lacks Jr., the grandson of Henrietta Lacks, will speak at that event tonight. Joining us now to tell us a little bit about this amazing story, David Lacks Jr., the grandson of Henrietta Lacks. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you for having me.
Your grandmother, Henrietta Lacks, died of cervical cancer at Johns Hopkins Hospital in 1951. What happened then?
Well, the story, as you alluded to earlier, back in 1951, she was admitted to the hospital. And as they would have, they were doing taking random samples of cancer, cells from anybody who came in to the hospital. They was taking cells and trying to cultivate them. But what had happened was Henrietta's, like I said, my grandmother's cells, once they took her cells, like I said, without consent or without knowledge, her cells were actually able to live and exist outside of her womb, outside of the human body. And they were the first cells to exist outside of the human body. So they made a miraculous discovery at that time when she checked in.
Mm-hmm. These are her cancer cells from...
Yes, these are her cancer cells. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain how the cancer cells continue to live on and multiply?
Well, since genome has come into effect, they believe that the HPV virus interacted with the genome, activating the gene called the MYC gene, and that causes the widespread of cancer. But to the day, really nobody knows. It just happened to be a coincidence or some kind of act of faith or if you're religious.
So it was purely by chance, except that her cells seem to continue to multiply and live on.
Yes, her cells are the most like resilient cells there are. Even to this day, they're still resilient. Most cells would die after a couple of days. Hers could go for a whole week without being fed or fed nutrition.
Today, these so-called HeLa cells are the most widely used human cell lines in existence. I alluded to a few of them, but can you tell us what advancements have been made with these HeLa cells, the cells from your grandmother?
Well, first, I mentioned the polio vaccine. They were the first cells to fly into space. They were basically used for the gene mapping, the Human Genome Project, used for cloning and vitro fertilization. And I just learned they used some HeLa cells recently to help come up with antidote for progeria that slows it down. Progeria is where young people rage rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain it to us? We're all non-medical people here, but how are these cells exactly used?
Well, basically, I guess because cells are able to live so long, they're able to test it. Sort of like if you're a cook in a restaurant, you're making up a dish, and then you have somebody taste test the dish. the HeLa cells, you know, the doctors and scientists come up with something, and they'll test it on the HeLa cells and see how it worked with that way, if that's a better, easier analogy. And then they, you know, record their results and see how things work out or come along.
So these cells have been sold, bought and sold by the billions since 1951, and your family did not know anything about it until when?
20 years later, by chance, my aunt was having dinner with a doctor and his wife, and she said he had asked, you're Henrietta Lacks. I mean, are you related to Henrietta Lacks? I'm working on her sales. And she was like, what? You know, I'm sure she said after that she had to get up on the table and just leave because she had no idea. Like I said, it was just a chance, like I said, again, a chance encounter at a dinner date.
She had to leave the table. What? Because she was just so surprised, or what?
Yes, we had no idea. Like I said, it was 20 years later after Henrietta had passed away, and then for somebody to just out of the blue tell you they're using a part of your her mother-in-law, that was quite a shock. And like I said, back then everybody didn't know, understand exactly what was going on. They just knew you had a piece of Henrietta Lacks that y'all still doing experiments on.
After that discovery was made by your family, what did your family do?
Actually, I'm not quite. She went back and told her husband. And from there, I guess some other magazines and some other publications came around. But like I said, we really didn't understand. They really didn't understand what was going on. And then like years later, doctors came and asked could they take blood samples from the children.
Mm-hmm. Now, your family was in the news this year when the National Institutes of Health shared that an agreement has been reached with your family regarding the use of these HeLa cells, your grandmother's cells in research. What was the agreement?
Well, the cells still can be bought and sold by the millions of tons or what have you, because it's just the cells. The cells are still out there. But what we reached the agreement is over the genome, because the genome is the genetic material, the genetic code, and that code is also passed down to us. So by revealing whatever medical information that we reveal about Henrietta Lacks, it will also reveal about the Lacks family.
So, and why is that potentially problematic for your family?
Well, you know, in most cases, like the HIPAA laws, medical records are kept confidential unless you want to release them. So, and we don't, you don't know what information is going to be out there. So, do they put a HeLa genome out there, and it reveals that we have some kind of genetic trait that would cause disease? It might cause, you know, our health insurance premiums to go up, or denied coverage. There's a whole wide range of things that could happen with that information out there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we all share part of Henrietta Lacks.
So with this new agreement, what is the process by which HeLa cells may be used? Do researchers, institutions have to do any further things to be able to use these cells now with this agreement?
Basically, what they do, they just go to the NIH website and fill out an application. Then a committee of six, but a committee will review it, and it consists of myself and Veronica Spencer, and we'll go over the application, make sure it meets with with the guidelines we set, and then if it does, we go ahead and approve it and release it to them to use.
What would be a red flag that you're looking for when you go through these applications that would lead your family to not be in agreement, to not approve this?
Well, at the moment, I guess we're looking at genealogy. We don't want it to go backwards to reveal anything that's reveal about the family. As of yet, we're not saying it's a total exclusiveness, that we, if it comes out to it, that we would then deny it. But for right now, we're just making sure it's stuff that pertains to the HeLa cell and nothing that could be related to the family members.
David Lacks, Jr., have you been in a laboratory with your grandmother's cells?
Yes. Johns Hopkins holds a microscope day once a year, and they invite people in to see the cells. So they invited me in to see the cells one day, and I got to look through them through an electron microscope.
What did they look like?
They look very beautiful because they had them multicolored. They look like red dots, and you've seen red and green rainbows because it was like the inside of the cell and the nucleus around it. It is beautiful, pretty.
Uh-huh. Now, did you know, were you alive when your grandmother was still living?
Oh, no, no.
Okay.
My grandmother passed away when my father was 4 years old.
Okay.
And 4 to 5 years old. And all he remembers, basically, it was like a dark, rainy night when she passed away and everybody wore black.
That must have been amazing at the laboratory at Johns Hopkins to be looking down at the cells. What were the thoughts you had? What are the feelings that you had?
It was like I was looking at a piece of my grandmother and never having the chance to know my grandmother. It's like, you know, you feel closely connected. It's like, wow, these cells came from my grandmother. Even though the cancer cell still contains her genetics, her traits of her genes, they're still in those cells, and I'm looking down at them. And my grandmother passed away like almost 60 years ago. So it's amazing. It's an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm. Now that this agreement has been reached, these cells may be used through this new process, what do you see looking back as the big takeaways from your grandmother's story?
Well, basically, we just wanted the world to know that she was a given woman. You know, she was given in life and that she's given in death. And, you know, her cells continue to, you know, heal the world and do good things. Mm-hmm.
I understand that some of your family members wanted a portion of the profits that companies were earning from research on HeLa cells. Is that your opinion, too, that some of the profits should go to your family?
Right now, I really can't. I don't know, because the other family members might have lawyers involved or something like that. I have no idea what's going on with that. Are we just happy that it's out there, though, basically? You know, we just pleased that with where her cells are doing.
Mm-hmm. And to be acknowledged that they are part of your family history.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is a fair price when your family cells are used, that there perhaps should be a price put on them?
Honestly, it would probably be incomprehensible because, I mean, the cells have been used all over the world. I mean, like I said, if you put all the cells in the end together, they wrap around the Earth 4 times and weigh several hundred tons.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't even comprehend how much, you know, somebody would be owed. But like I said, when we focus on the fact that, you know, the good that they have done for the world.
Do you have any idea why your family's cells should be so resilient?
Like I said, I don't know. Nobody knows to this day.
Is your family, as a family, especially resilient?
Well, I rarely get sick, so I have to think maybe some of them genes are in me and my children because we rarely get sick. So I like to think that's the case, but I don't know.
You know, when we think about the bigger picture here, David Lax, have you thought about how we balance the benefits of studying cells, studying genomes, for example, with the risks to the privacy of the people whose genomes are studied?
Like I said, it has to be a balance. We need scientists, medical community, patients, and the public needs to work together because we need medical care to benefit of us all. So it does need some, you know, it needs to be a balance there. But at the same time, you know, you don't want your whole life exposed. There's already enough information about us out on a worldwide web or anywhere else.
Do you know if laws have been changed now so that if a person would die of cancer, for instance, do the people, the family, have the right to control what's done with the tissues once they've been removed?
No, laws have not changed. Still, once your tissues are removed, it's still considered discarded waste, so scientists can do whatever they want. But laws may have to be changed because now with the ability to sequence human tissue, before, you know, as long as you couldn't identify the tissue, it was okay to use and do whatever you want to it. But as time goes on, it's going to be easier and easier to identify who that tissue belonged to. So no laws have changed yet, but I'm suspecting in the future that they will.
Now, since this book has come out and become very popular, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lax, is your name recognized more when you're in public?
In schools and medical communities. And when I was sick one day, I went to the doctors and got a medicine. Lady's like, aren't you David Lax? I was like, yes. And she's like, oh, can I take a picture with you on study? And I'm like, okay, I'm trying to get my medicine. But I'll take a picture with you. So I went ahead and took a picture with her, and I went and got my medicine.
So people
recognize us. And when my father, he came down, he went to a McDonald's, and the woman almost fell out. She's like, oh, my God, I know who you are. You're David Lax. He's like, ah. She went around and gave him a big hug. And I guess another instance where my children's teacher, She's been a teacher for several years, but once she found out who I was, she just had to come and thank me and hug me and talk to me because she was diagnosed with cancer and she's in remission now. But she just made it her mission that she wanted to see me once she found out who I was.
Mm-hmm. What does that feel like to have your bit of celebrity there because of cells taken from your grandmother's body?
Well, it feels good that, like I said, again, the cells have done so much and that people will start to recognize it because, like I said, I've known about the cells since elementary school, and it was like a little secret that nobody knew about it. Like I said, I knew they discovered, helped cure polio, but not much else, and nobody else in the world knew about it. And now that it's finally out that, you know, her cells have done so much, I'm happy about it, and I appreciate all that comes with it.
David Lax Jr., it's been a pleasure to talk with you. We want to remind our listeners again that you and Victoria Baptiste, that's your grandmother's great-granddaughter, will be speaking at an event tonight, and it's at the lower level of the Sheraton Hotel in Iowa City at 7 p.m., An Evening with the Lax Family, the story behind the immortal life of Henrietta Lax, this evening at 7 p.m. as part of the 2013 Iowa Book Festival. Thank you, David, for this conversation.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Just in case that information about the event was not immortalized in your memory, we have it on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if you're like me, after hearing that story, those comments from David Lax Jr. about the immortal life of his grandmother, Henrietta Lax, and the fact that even though she died in 1951, her cells live on indefinitely in labs throughout the world. Did he say tons of them around the world? I'm sure he did. You're asking yourself what exactly they do with these HeLa cells. What makes them so special? And joining me now to answer these and other questions in our Iowa City studio, Scott Rose, current director of product development, former director of molecular genetics at Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville. Scott Rose, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Full disclosure, Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville, an underwriter for Iowa Public Radio. Also in our Iowa City studio, Martine Dunwald, research assistant professor of pediatrics, also adjunct assistant professor of genetics and molecular biology and cellular biology at the University of Iowa. Martine, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with you, Scott, because you were vigorously nodding and reacting to that interview with David Lax. You have used HeLa cells many times, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. Right from the start in my graduate school career, one of the first cell lines I was ever introduced to was the HeLa cell line, and it formed the bit of a lot of the research that I was doing where we were trying to understand how a certain process was carried out. And in order to do that, we knew we had to go back to the basics and strip everything down to the smallest component possible. And that meant instead of working in an entire organism, going back to the cell, and the cell contained all the machinery, all the proteins, everything it needed to do this process that we were interested in. So what that meant for us was that we would grow up huge quantities, maybe not tons and tons of these cells, but we'd have these giant, you know, multi-gallon containers that we would grow up these cells, harvest the cells, break them open, and then get that material inside. And we were able to use that material inside to tease out all the various biological processes.
What does that mean, tease out? Is there an analogy we can use that more of us have an idea about? What does that mean to tease out a cell?
Well, because a cell is it's a small thing, if you think about it, right? It's a little bag, if you will, something. A little cell membrane comprised with a bunch of proteins inside of it. But it's very, very complex in all the different functions it does. And a lot of these things interact and interrelate. So in order to be able to study one particular portion of that, you have to separate out all the other components. And you can do that very simply by something we call fractionation, which is basically separating out different components until we get to the ones that just do what we want them to do. Mm-hmm. And they determine their identity, how they work, what's required for them to work, and then we can go on and then put them back into the cell and say, okay, how do they fit into the bigger picture?
Martine Dunwald, what's your connection to HeLa cells?
So I came to HeLa cells much later. My first encounter was to use them really as a tool. And kind of as it was said, for us to understand disease as biologists, we need to simplify things. And cells are kind of the smallest building block of the human body. And in order to understand how we work and how we don't work well sometimes, being able to understanding and simplifying it at the building block level is much easier.
Mm-hmm.
So my actually primary encounter with tissue culture was not using HeLa cells, which are really a tool because, as it was said in the interview, these cells keep going on and on and on, and it make our life as scientists much easier because, as you say, we don't need to feed them all the time. We don't need to give them food every day or every other day. We can just leave them where they're at. So I was interested in growing cells from patient to understand how some of these cells do the things we want them to do or don't do things that we want them to do. And culturing cells from real patient is labor intensive. It's complicated. It's not trivial. So being able to use cells that divide all the time and we don't need to feed very often was a great tool for us to then go back to cells from real patient, or I would say cells that we call primary cells versus these immortal cells that go on forever.
The question I have is still not clear to me. Are there anything really special? Could these cells have come from another person, another woman with cervical cancer? These are cancer cells. Or is there something very special about the DNA of Henrietta Lacks' family?
Well, there is something very special about it in that, yes, other cells could have given rise to a cervical cancer. The key here was that these particular cells, they got infected with the human papillomavirus. And a portion of this human papillomavirus got what we call integrated or got inserted or put into the genetic material of Henrietta. It was the location, among other things, as well as how much of the virus that got put into her, got integrated into her genome, that triggered this carcinogenic event.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of things. The particular virus, I think it was HPV-18, had to be infected into her, had to get into those cells, and then it had to integrate into her genome in a spot where it would cause havoc. And it's exactly what happened, and it integrated next to a gene that's known to that is it's involved in the body to turn signals on and off. You know, have events occur and then shut them back down again. You turn something on and you can't shut it back off again. It's not long before a lot of havoc can ensue, and that's basically what happened. That's the leading idea behind what drove her carcinogenic event.
Okay, we're going to take a break. And Scott, if you don't mind, we're going to take a break also to wrap our heads around what you just said about cells. We're getting a quick lesson on molecular biology, cell biology, with Scott Rose of Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville and Martine Dunwald of the University of Iowa. We're talking about the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. And Scott and Martine will be with us when we come back to talk about these cells, how they're used, the ethics of it, how it relates to animal testing, for instance, and a little more with Martine about collecting other cells, growing cells for research. We'll be back in just a moment. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, it's a News Buzz edition of our program. And in one of the little flybys, we'll talk with the president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club. It was that group that sent messages to the spacecraft Juno as it was doing a gravity assist flyby of the Earth. Did you know that? It happened this week, I think Wednesday. It's on its way to explore Jupiter. We'll find out about that tomorrow on the program. Today on the program, the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. Now, Henrietta Lacks died of cervical cancer at Johns Hopkins Hospital in 1951, but her cancer cells continued to grow outside her body, and now these cells, known to many researchers in the decades since as HeLa cells, are the most widely used human cell lines in existence today, leading to cancer cures, treatments for HIV, Parkinson's, in vitro fertilization, all kinds of things. Polio vaccine, influenza vaccine, these HeLa cells have played a role in that, even studied in outer space, as long as we're talking about space. Joining me now, in our Iowa City studio, Martine Dunwald, research assistant professor at the University of Iowa, pediatrics, also Scott Rose, director of product development at Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville. We have a few more minutes to talk here. Let's talk about, I listed some of the big breakthroughs that are connected with HeLa cells. Let me turn to you, Martina, and have us talk for a few minutes about the benefits, the gratitude we need to show to HeLa cells and the Lax family.
So I think that in addition to all of the things that you mentioned, so from polio and other progresses, I really see the benefit of the HeLa cells as having allow us to develop all of the technology that we scientists use today. So these cells, actually, once they were isolated in Dr. Gay's lab, were shipped throughout the world for free. And because they were so resistant, people learned how to ship cells to other places and ship cells alive and not having them die in the truck or in the plane or in... they learned how to maintain cells. So you can actually freeze cells down. So we can take cells, whether they are these cell lines or other people's cells, and we can freeze them and we can keep them for years and years and years so that we can eventually take them out.
When you thaw them, will they be alive? No.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Is that true of all cells?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? Okay. Didn't know that. Okay. Go on, Martine.
So all of these little things that we today take for granted, I think, have been able to be established using these initial cell lines. And because these HeLa cells were so resistant, what kind of food should we give them to maintain them? What kind of vitamins should be in the food we give them? All of these things that we use today actually were developed starting with the HeLa cells and with other cell lines afterwards.
Okay. Tell us more, Scott Rose, about some of the benefits connected with HeLa cells in research.
Well, some of the benefits are not financial ones in terms of intangible. We can produce a product with them. But there's been over 74,000 publications, scientific peer-reviewed publications in the literature, where people have asked a variety of different questions on all sorts of aspects of biology, whether it be biochemistry, whether it be genetics, whether it be enzymology, whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is, all this stuff came from basically using the HeLa cell or the components in a HeLa cell to do these experiments. So there's a huge amount of knowledge, basic background foundational knowledge that came out of this. Mm-hmm. And that is invaluable.
Obviously a very complex area. We could spend a lot of time with 74,000 publications involved here. We could talk until the end of our lives and still not reach all these publications. Let's talk a little bit about the ethics, because this story also deals with ethical concerns. A first reaction that I had to this story was, what? These cells were taken from Henrietta Lacks's body without her consent, reproduced, used in research. The family didn't even find out about it. And only found out it by chance 20 years after her death. How can that be? Is that within the law, Scott?
At the time, that was perfectly legal and to some extent still is. Now, obviously, there's more informed consent that has to be obtained before a patient can samples can be taken from a patient and used. But it is still an area that has not fully regulated, and there are a lot of questions and gray areas.
Now, Martine Dunwald, I understand you grow cells, not HeLa cells. You grow also HeLa cells, but you also grow other cells from people who are actually living. You'll take a tissue sample and grow their cells for certain reasons.
Yes.
What are the ethics involved with that? What hurdles do you have to jump?
So there's actually kind of two categories, if I could put it this way. In one case, we can collect, as it was done for Henrietta Lacks, we can collect discarded tissue. So once you go in operation and if there is pieces of tissue that would be naturally discarded, these don't belong to you. And if we scientists want to use them and never make any attempt to identify who they were coming from, so we just take that piece of tissue and assign it a number for us in the laboratory with no way ever to go back to the genetic information or anything else, we can do that. And we call that de-identified samples. But
somebody knows who that tissue sample belongs to, don't they, Martine? If they really wanted to find out and they had
a good
computer hacker, maybe.
What I would add is that we as investigator, we cannot do whatever we want.
Okay.
So we are regulated. We need to ask permission to the institution that we work for to write a protocol. The protocol needs to be read and needs to be approved. So it's not like I would be waiting at the outside of the operation room collecting samples in the garbage. I can't do that. However, I would say that we can also study cells from patients and individuals that we know who they are. And for that, we cannot just do it without their consent. This doesn't happen today anymore.
Scott Rose, talk about the ethics that you're involved in when you grow cells, perhaps HeLa cells.
Sure. Since I'm not growing primary cells, we obtain all our cells from a cell bank, if you will, called ATCC. And this is a company that's mentioned in the book even, where they supply different cell types to you, frozen down, as we were discussing earlier. And these cells are viable. You have to sign some paperwork, agree to use them under certain conditions. So there's release forms that have to be filled out. But once that's all done, these cells are sent to you to a verified address. They can't just send them to your house. It has to be a bona fide research institution or commercial entity. But then you can get those cells, and then you can use those. And that's what we do. We do not accept cells from any outside sources, only from this particular approved institution.
Okay. Two things I want to talk about in the couple minutes that we have remaining. This 2013 NIH agreement with the Lax family that was discussed by David Lax Jr., the grandson there, in the first half hour, they have to have a hand in reviewing how HeLa cells are used. Has that changed your lives as researchers on the ground at all? Were you aware of that NIH agreement?
Yes, I was. It's been recently cited in a fair number of different trade publications, online publications for the people who are into human genetics or whatever, to realize these are going to be some of the limitations for getting the genome, the sequence from HeLa cells. Now, that's not true for other human genomes that were isolated from other sources. Just the HeLa cell. So it's a big differential there.
Okay. And Martine, does it change your life?
I would say not yet, but I think it will, because I think with the advancement of genetics, these discarded tissue or unidentified tissue might, as you were alluding, be able to be identified one day. And I think that it may change the way we're looking at discarded tissue and may have to ask permission or informed consent for everyone in the future. So I think it will.
And very quickly, this relates to animal testing. Because of the existence of HeLa cells, we need to do less animal
tests. Absolutely.
Yeah.
In our laboratory, when we're testing for new compounds, one of the things we look for is what effect is that compound going to have on the health of the cell? We want to make sure it's not going to poison it, not going to cause it to not grow. All these things can be done very quickly, very fast, and cheaply with these HeLa cells that don't require an animal. It's very fast, it's economical, and uncovers a lot of potential problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great usage.
Now, we know there are certain rules and procedures for humanely treating animals, these organisms made up of lots of cells. Of course, debates, animal rights activists, we've talked about it on this program. Animal testing, highly contentious. Are there rules, humane ways to treat cells, that individual level of life? Martine?
Well,
can you do what you want with them?
No. I think that there are, again, when I obtain cells, I need to have an authorization from my institution to collect tissue and to use these cells. I describe very in detail what these cells will be used for. So I think that we're not free to do anything we want. I think institutions, especially the University of Iowa, is regulating what we can do with them.
Scott Rose.
I'm sorry, I'm just getting a little chuckle here. As far as actually humane cells, these cells are very robust, as has been mentioned, but they do require some conditions. So they have their own special, what we call incubators that are at a certain temperature because they really like a particular temperature, certain humidity. They get these special foods. They get treated pretty doggone well.
Do they?
Yes, they do.
Okay. Fascinating area. Thank you both for sharing some of it with us. Scott Rose, Director of Product Development at Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville, Martine Dunwald of the University of Iowa, where you are a research assistant professor of pediatrics. We appreciate this. Fascinating insights. Thanks for coming into our studio today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and finally this hour, we want to talk to a science writer about a related area, her decision to donate her body to medical research after she dies. Now, these musings by Brooke Borrell about her decision to do so were recently published online in Eon Magazine under the title, I'd Rather Be Dissected. There are not enough whole body donations to science. Why don't people want their death to help the living? Brooke Borrell joins us by phone for the last few minutes of the hour. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You're a science writer. Your work has appeared in Slate, Discover, BBC Future. You're a contributing editor for Popular Science, and I understand you recently also wrote an article about for Popular Science on how to donate your body to science.
That's out right now in the October issue, yes.
But let's talk about this article that you wrote about the decision, the very personal decision of what will happen to your body when you die. You start off the article by writing about the day it was a take our daughters to work day with your father. And your father happened to be a pathologist, a former county coroner. So you spent the day in an autopsy room watching your father dissect a dead man.
Yes, this is correct. Probably a little bit unusual compared to what my peers were doing that day. But
how old were you?
Dad. I was in seventh grade. I was 13.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember?
I was actually, go ahead. Sorry.
What do you remember most about that day?
As I describe in that essay, it was the first time I had ever seen a dead body, and I remember very distinctly watching my dad as he was doing this work and being kind of just actually very amazed at the kind of work that he did. I, of course, knew what he did, but I hadn't pictured that sort of physical work that it entailed before. But it was really interesting, and also, it was a bit sad, this, person was dead on this table in front of me going through this autopsy. But it was also really interesting. I was always really interested in science and medicine. So it was a positive, good experience, an interesting experience.
What did you notice most about how your father went about his work? You'd known your father as your father, never seen him work this way with dead with a cadaver. What did you notice about that? Yeah.
Well, I mean, just as you see with any professional going about their work, just sort of having a mastery over it. And also to him, I mean, it was funny when I talked to him about writing this essay, he actually, at first, he remembers now after we've talked about it more, but at first he didn't even remember that I had gone and watched him do this autopsy. And I think that's partly because it was such typical day-to-day work for him. It didn't feel like something so unusual, even though, I mean, to us it probably seems kind of unusual to have a 13-year-old in an autopsy room.
Right.
In
your essay, if I can quote a little from your essay, I especially remember watching my dad cleave through the outer edges of the man's ribs with an electric striker saw and then lift off his chest like the lid of a box. I also remember thinking, is this really my dad?
Yeah, that moment was actually my most distinct memory was seeing him pull that saw out. I mean, my dad's a lovely, wonderful person, but not someone I normally even think of as using tools. You know, like he's not exactly, I never would have even pictured him having a saw in his hand, let alone in this context. So it was just a really sort of surreal experience. Yeah.
You also talk about in the article how you had a lot of conversations about death around the dinner table. What sort of conversations?
Well, I mean, just like with any family, and I mentioned this in the essay, you know, you spend time around the dinner table talking about your day. And my dad, of course, was a pathologist, but also at that time where I grew up in Kansas in Shawnee County, there was not a permanent coroner in the county. So a lot of the pathologists at different hospitals would take turns, at least that's my understanding, filling that role. So he would have a lot of stories about his work as a coroner, having to go to crime scenes and death scenes. and telling us, you know, some of the stuff that had happened that day.
And there and there you are eating your plate of spaghetti?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed very normal at the time. And sometimes I would have friends over and they were probably horrified or maybe not. I mean, this was also at an age where it perhaps hadn't sunk in the gravity of some of those stories. It was felt maybe a little bit more like a ghost story or something like that. I was always, you know, very into ghost stories and kind of scary stories. So I think then I looked at it more from that angle. Now I think about it in a little bit of a different way, thinking about the people in those stories a little bit more.
Brooke Burrell, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. So let's get to how this your background, your father's work, witnessing that, the talk at the dinner table, how it ties in with your decision, which you shared in this article, to donate your body to science. Connect it.
Sure. I've been thinking a lot lately on this topic, partly because I was writing the story for Popular Science and also working on this essay, and just learning about the different ways that bodies are needed in different areas of research. And in talking to a lot of the scientists and doctors that do that kind of research, learning that they're really usually, I mean, they'll make do with what they have, but there's not really enough going around for them to do a lot of this really important work. I was thinking about how I've always been an organ donor, which is also incredibly important. I'm not trying to say that people should not be organ donors and instead do whole body donations. But, you know, there are a lot of different options out there, and it's a very personal decision, of course. But in realizing that there was a need for this and realizing that I could do some good for people in a lot of different ways after I die, that really led me to this decision.
Mm-hmm. And to quote from your article, a way for my death to make life better for the living. Now, you talked about whole body donation, and of course, consent is a big part of that, right? Because there is this a seedy side to this business, isn't there?
Yeah, there can be. The regulations on it gets a little murky in some respects. I would encourage people to look and see what the situation is in their particular state. It's my understanding is it's not legal to ever sell an entire body or anything like that, but there are some cases where you might donate your body for organ donation, for example. And my understanding is that some of the leftover tissues, collagen, that kind of stuff, could then be sold to companies that make fillers for cosmetic injections and that kind of stuff out of cadaver fat and other tissues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, but people should be aware the different places they might end up and make sure that they make the decision that they feel most comfortable with.
You give some examples about the ways that whole body donations are used, improving safety belts, for instance, right?
Or, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or what else did you say?
There are a few. There's the main categories are so the safety belts and other transportation stuff, or that's sort of like trauma kind of situations where the body might be injured in a car or a train or what have you. Also, recreational stuff sort of falls into that category, sports injuries and other kinds of injuries. I mentioned football helmets, for example, right, would need to be tested, and sometimes using either models that were built based on cadavers or with some sort of related research.
We're running out of time. Medical student cadaver would be another area. We have just a minute left.
The decision I've made is the...
You have made your decision, because in the article you said you hadn't made the exact decision.
Well, I have made the decision. I'm still sorting out the paperwork, but that, for me, the connection to my father's work into the medical field, that's what felt like the right decision for me personally and the right place to decide for where my body should go.
And you'd researched about how important that can be for a medical student to that first encounter with a cadaver, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Brooke Burrell, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Where else will your writing take you here in the future? What are you working on now?
My biggest project right now is a book that's actually on bed bugs, and that's due early next year and will be out sometime next year.
Oh, yeah. Those little critters, unfortunately, are not resigned to history. They're back, aren't they?
They are back, yeah.
And in New York, where you are right now, right?
Yeah. I've actually had them 3 times, which in New York, which is partly what inspired the book. But also, they're really interesting, and, of course, their comeback is is continuing all over the country and all over the world.
We'll look forward to that. Brooke Borrell, science writer, the work appeared in several publications. This last one, I'd Rather Be Dissected, talking about what she wants to have happen to her body, makes us all think about that. Brooke Borrell, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much.
These were the very last words that you said. Please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. No, I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane. The blind could have my eyes and the deaf could take. Oh, that my ears, if they don't mind the size.
A little bit of John Prine to end our show today. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We have a News Buzz edition of our program tomorrow. Hope you'll join us for that. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
A Venus de Milo can have my arms. Look out, I got your nose. Sell my heart to the junk man and give my love to Rose. But please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have